everyone. Welcome to another episode of Options Discovery. Today, I'm going to be sitting down with Rich Excel. He is currently a clinical assistant professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he's an experienced senior portfolio manager. Rich, can you give us a little bit of a background and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, it's a long story, actually, but I started my career I graduated from U of I back last century and started my career trading on the floor at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange as a market maker, options market maker in foreign exchange. I quickly moved up to the upstairs OTC business and ended up moving to Asia for most of the 90s. And then I moved back to the US and switched out of investment bank sales and trading into the world of hedge funds, and did that for the next 20 years. Through 2020, and again, got to get a chance to live abroad and work abroad, et cetera, on different hedge fund strategies. And then in 2016, I started kind of going down to U of I because I had a daughter down there, and we started to work with students, teach one class here or there. And before I knew it, I was teaching two classes per semester. And then I decided I was pretty busy. So I'm like, something's got to give. So I retired from the world of managing money for people and now focus fully on teaching at U of I, where I teach a number of different things, including derivative strategy type ideas. And then I do a lot of consulting in the options world as well. So that's kind of a very quick overview of where I've got, but options have been a part of my life really since I interned during my college years.
It's funny that you mentioned Champaign, because I'm actually a UIC student. So we're kind of like sister universities, I guess you could say. How did you use different option strategies in your career as a portfolio manager?
So, when I managed portfolios for the investment bank, that was really kind of global prop trading. And so we used a lot of option strategies for kind of tactical directional trading, maybe for implementing carry trade ideas, et cetera. And that was a time, early days, especially over the counter, where exotic options were becoming very, very popular. And so there was a lot of edge that we could kind of pick up on some carry trade ideas, et cetera. When I moved to the world of hedge funds and really started my career in equity long short, I kind of came at it again from, I'm coming in from a world of a macro background. I'd gotten my CFA charter. So I was really well versed in bottom-up fundamental analysis, but I felt my competitive advantage versus a lot of people was understanding the macro environment, one, but two, understanding how options are priced and what the market is telling you about that. And so if I think about it from a fundamental equity analyst, for instance, perspective, when you're building out a target price in your model, you're building a DCF model, you're building a target price, really the better models are the ones that do a scenario analysis, and they think about what could go right, a bullish case, what if my forecasts could be even better than I thought, or what could go wrong? What if, a bearish case? What if my forecasts are too optimistic already? And so right there, even with three data points, you're starting to develop a distribution of outcomes. And so as a fundamental analyst, you have a view on a distribution of what could happen to any particular stock. Well, now you can take that distribution, you can look at the what's being priced in the options market, and you say to yourself, okay, well, what does the options market think about what's going to happen in this particular stock? And so then when you compare those, more than just simply buying a stock or selling a stock or going long or going short, you can start to say, okay, maybe there are better ways for me to express my long or short ideas using option strategies. They don't have to be sophisticated, but even some sort of option strategies that will give me leverage to win when I'm right, or give me some built-in risk management when I'm wrong. That's kind of how I really, in an equity long short portfolio, really started to use a lot of option strategies. Now, of course, you can also do them where you can do calendar spreads around particular catalysts, et cetera, and that's really effective. And often, the beauty of options is you don't have to have a directional view, right? Sometimes your view might be on, I think nothing's going to happen, or I don't know which way it's going to move, but I think it's going to move a lot. And so I think there's just a lot of different ways you can really express yourself with options, more so than just a linear buy or sell a stock that I think really provides a competitive advantage. Now, of course, you have to know what you're doing with those, and then you have to actively risk manage those. They're not typically set it and forget it type strategies. But it for me in my career, whether it was in kind of macro global prop or in equity long short, et cetera, you know, that's I found that my competitive advantage was using different option strategies. And then for a short time around the financial crisis, I also ran a tail risk fund where, you know, we're looking for asymmetric payouts in the case of cataclysmic events. And that's, you know, right up the alley of using options across different asset classes, et cetera. So I've always actively looked to use option strategies. I've always looked to the options market for the information that comes from it. I think there's a lot of information investors could glean from the options market if they know where to look. And then that's really ultimately what we're trying to determine as any sort of investor or trader is we have our own views of what's going to happen, but what's being priced in and where's my view different? And then, so I think that's where there's a lot of value that we can get from options.
So your use of the option strategies has been pretty versatile over your management career. Pivoting away from your management part of your career, can you tell our viewers a little bit more about your blog, Excel with Options? What influenced you to start this blog and what kind of options related content do you cover?
Sure. So it kind of before Excel with Options, I would always write a chart of the day or do something every day on LinkedIn. And I did it. I started to do it really actively when I started teaching, and I did it as a way to kind of engage with the students and show them, okay, this is the types of things you should be thinking about. And I would talk about it in class. I'm like, I'm going to put it out every day on LinkedIn to have a look. We'll talk about it in class. I wanted to try to encourage them to do the same, to kind of put themselves out there in a positive light on the social media and show people what they knew, et cetera. And what I found is that it was getting a lot of traction, not just with my students, but with other people as well. And so I kind of kept doing it more and more and kind of got into writing some other blogs. And then it was the CME that approached me and said, hey, would you mind or would you be interested in doing something where you look across our different products and come up with kind of different option strategies? Because the CME is always trying to appeal to different audiences. For some products, they're looking to appeal to more retail audiences, and other products they're looking to appeal to more institutional audiences, depending on where they think they need to work. And so I partner with them, and I look across every other week. We look at a different CME product, a different business group, so everything from crypto to agriculture to interest rates, FX, equities, energy, metals. And so for me, it's exciting because it kind of goes back to my days when I did global macro and have to look at all the different asset classes and kind of quickly come up to speed on what's the driving force, et cetera. And then what I think is the right option strategy. It's also exciting to be able to engage with the people in the business and think about where we can kind of meet the potential audience on what's interesting to them. And so I really enjoy doing it. It's gotten some pretty good traction with the audience. I think it would just try to, again, I don't put it that we every other week we put a trade idea or two out there. And the goal is not that you should follow these trade ideas and make money. That's not the goal at all. We're not trying to give investment advice. The goal is to show people what's possible. Like if this was your view or you were thinking something like this, consider doing this sort of strategy because the options market is pricing X. And therefore, you should take advantage of what the market's giving you to express your view in this way. And so it's really done from an educational light to trying to say, the best thing to do is to take what the market's giving you. If the market's bidding up downside puts and you're bearish, you might have to find a way to sell puts even within a bearish context because you don't want to be buying what everyone else is buying or selling what everyone else is selling. And that's really kind of the premise. But again, I look at it and approach it from the light of what I've done and kind of from a macro perspective, and it helps keep me current. And so I really enjoy doing it.
I think that's a really interesting how you kind of started it for your students, and then it's evolved to this larger educational blog. I'm going to be holding my professors at UIC to that same standard now.
I encourage you to do it. I mean, it's great. I tell you what, a lot of my colleagues at U of I started to read that. They would use some of my charts in their classes, and then now increasingly more and more of them are doing it themselves. And I think it's awesome. I think it's just more people putting out good content that helps demystify finance for everybody, I think is only a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I've seen a few of your Stay Vigilant blogs on LinkedIn. But no, thank you for giving a little bit of an introduction to yourself. We're going to be talking about the main topic for today, which is covered call ETFs, specifically JEP-E and JEP-Q, which are the two JP Morgan covered call ETFs. But before we get into that, can you talk a little bit about what covered called ETFs actually are, and what are some of the advantages and what are some of the disadvantages?
Sure. So I think when you think about covered call ETFs, I think it's important to break it down into two component pieces. First is a covered call strategy, and then the second is doing that within an ETF. Okay, so for a covered call strategy, those have been around for a long time, right? It's not just been the purview of hedge funds. In fact, it's been the purview of a lot of financial advisors or institutional investors that would hold stocks and want to overwrite their holdings with calls, et cetera, as a way to take a little bit of yield and income out of the market while they're waiting for something to happen. And, you know, it kind of harkens back to a study by an investment consultant, Callan, back in 2006, which is kind of the big study that people kind of point to that showed the advantages of covered call strategies. And it looked at a period from 1988 to 2006 and showed that, just the Cboe buy right strategy, that's the BXM index, if you compare that to the other broad indexes, it had at the time in that for that period, that 18-year period, it had same returns as the SPX at half the volatility. And so the risk adjusted returns were superior. And it had actually had better returns than the Russell and better returns than bond market, same volatility. And so, you know, it was, if you think of it from an efficient frontier standpoint, it was a superior strategy to all of them. And so, of course, money flows into that, right? Money flows into it at the institutional level, et cetera. And so if we updated that that study as of today, last time I looked at it was like 2021, the returns to that strategy has suffered a little bit, but it still has superior risk-adjusted returns. It doesn't have the same returns as the SPX, but it really does a great job of reducing volatility. And so when you think of a covered call strategy, what are the three component pieces? Part one is passive equity exposure, being exposed to whatever index you want to be exposed to. Now, part two is volatility risk premia and being able to take some of that implied volatility risk premia above the realized volatility, take that out as income. And then is market timing. And that comes down to how the strategy is actually executed. And that kind of gets into some of the differences on the different benchmarks or the different strategies. And we'll talk about that later. But then you think about why do this within an ETF and not within a mutual fund or within some other sort of strategy. And that kind of gets to the tax advantage nature, the tax efficient nature of an ETF structure versus an actively managed mutual fund. Now these are actively managed, but because you're rolling the call overwrite over and over. However, because of an ETF structure, there are minimal capital gains that the investor has to pay. Mutual funds have to pay capital gains, not just on how the overall mutual fund does, but on every transaction the mutual fund manager does. And so ETFs have a superior tax efficiency to mutual funds. And that's why there still will be capital gains within this, but that's why this becomes within an ETF structure a more appealing way to do a covered call strategy, unless, of course, you're doing it in a pension fund or an IRA or some other sort of tax efficient vehicle. And so the covered call within the ETF structure that, you know, that the JEPI and JEPQ are probably two of the biggest to do is really aimed at taking, again, this covered call strategy, which has shown superior risk adjusted returns, and putting it within a tax efficient structure.
So the tax efficiency, as well as the income, which I think you were talking about earlier, JEP-E and JEP-Q are income-driven ETFs. In what ways does an investor receive income from these ETFs?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so let's just look at JEPI for over the last 12 months, okay? If we look at the total return of the JEPI over the last 12 months, it's about 11%, okay? Now let's break that down into two pieces. The first piece is the price return of the ETF. And that was actually negative 1%. And so the second piece of that is the dividend yield of the structure. And that was roughly about 12%. And so the 11% total return is minus one price return, but plus 12 on dividend yield. And so it's really designed to be a dividend yield ETF. It's not necessarily designed to give you superior price appreciation. It has a lower beta than one to a benchmark like the SPX. It's meant to be lower beta, but it's meant to generate this income. Now, then you ask, where does that income come from? And it comes from two pieces. Even though it's all called dividend yield for the purposes of the ETF, some of it, in fact, probably less than half of it, is actually the dividend income from the stock component stocks that JEPI holds. I think we'll talk about a little bit of what it holds and why it holds that versus the benchmark, but it holds stocks that not all the stocks it holds will pay a dividend, but it's trying to hold stocks that will pay some sort of dividend yield. The broader SPX has a dividend yield in and around 2%. And so let's just say that JEPI's dividend yield is something similar. Where's that incremental 10% coming from? That incremental 10% is coming from the premium from selling all these call options. And they're selling call options on a month-by-month basis. And say, for instance, if you're collecting 80 basis points in premium every month times 12 months, there's about 10% of option premium that's augmenting your dividend income. Now, this dividend is paid out on a monthly basis, which tells you right there that it's option premium. That's a big driver of the dividend yield to the ETF. And so that's really where, that's the biggest part where you're getting the returns to that. JPQ is very similar. It's a different benchmark. It's the NASDAQ instead of the SPX. Last year, if we look at it, the price return was around 4.5%. And again, it had dividend yield around 12%. And you think about that, a lot of the tech stocks in the NASDAQ don't pay much of a dividend at all, but they have really high implied volatility. So you're getting a lot more volatility premium that you're capturing, and that's what's driving that dividend yield. So the income is coming mostly from the option premium that's being taken, harvested from the market. And that kind of goes back to what I talked about before, where you have passive equity plus volatility risk premium, plus market timing. The volatility risk premium is a big, big piece of that.
So other than the obvious benefit of having like this income flow coming in, what are some of the other advantages? I know you talked a little bit about beta, but how does duration come into play?
Well, I mean, how does the duration, these are generally short duration, right? Because the options that most of them in JEPI and JPQ keep their cards pretty close to the vest. They don't really tell us exactly what they're doing. But you can tell based on the dividend premium, and you can tell based on some of the holdings that they have, that for the most part, they're selling 1 month options, whether they be at the money or slightly out of the money. And so it's a very fairly short duration vehicle, right? And they're relying on dividend premium, et cetera. What they're really looking to do, the biggest advantage is they're reducing the volatility of their overall strategy. And so because of this premium that they're taking in, even in down markets, the total return of the ETF will be much more muted than what we saw, for instance, in 2022, where the stock markets were down considerably, right? And so it really reduces the volatility of the overall strategy. So that's what helps the risk-adjusted return. And that's what we've seen through time is cover call strategies materially outperform their benchmarks, and benchmarks being like the SPX, for instance, in down markets more than up markets. In fact, they usually do the worst in strong bull markets, which is what we saw in like 2021. And that's because you're consistently going through your upside call option and you're getting called, taken out of your position. So strong bull markets is when these strategies usually suffer. Sideways markets or down markets is when these strategies tend to do the best. And that's what people will benefit from the most. They'll benefit as well. They can benefit in high volatility regimes because you're collecting more option premium. And so there's a lot of advantages, especially in down markets, even though it has a positive beta for these types of strategies. And that's why investors have historically liked them.
So the main, I guess, benefits would be the income from the dividend yield and the premium, and then also the lower volatility that it would offer an investor. Thank you for that explanation.
Yeah, and so that, I mean, I think about it. So from an institutional perspective, they are trying to maximize risk-adjusted returns. And that's what they're going to market themselves to the asset owners. So pension funds, endowments, et cetera, that are allocating to institutional investors. They're going to be looking at their Sharpe ratio or essentially their risk-adjusted returns or a Sortino ratio, something like that, that shows how Their active management allows them to have a similar sort of return to the market with a lower volatility. And that's how they kind of show the benefits of that. For an individual, it might be that they, hey, I want to continue to hold these stocks, but I know sometimes these stocks are going to go nowhere, so I might as well try to generate some incremental income. And the example I always give is, my grandmother owned AT&T stock forever, and the stock didn't necessarily go anywhere, but you could get a little bit of a dividend. You could sell some calls against it, and grandma could get 6 or 7% every year, and she was happy owning her AT&T, even though it didn't go anywhere. So that's the advantage to an individual. They can still own a stock that they may have had for a long time that they don't necessarily want to take the capital gains from, but you can roll over call strategies and just get some income to live on out of that as well.
Thank you for that brief example. I think that puts things into perspective a little bit. So JEPI or JEPI focuses on writing out of the money calls on the S&P. And I think out of the 500 companies, they have a little over 100 with large sectors in financials and healthcare. So what makes certain stock more attractive to the JEPI portfolio when compared to other stocks on the S&P?
Sure. So the first thing you highlight there, which is great, is that JEPI owns about 100 companies out of 500, right? And so when you look at when you look at any sort of strategist trying to replicate a benchmark, it's trying to do it with the fewest number of stocks possible, right? It's trying to have the highest correlation, the lowest tracking error, as well as the lowest execution costs. And so it's trying to minimize minimize tracking error and minimize execution costs. And what we have historically found is 100 companies does a really good job. It gets you probably about above a 95% correlation for the most part. In fact, if you look at options market makers that will trade the S&P 500 and they'll trade individual stocks against that, they typically will only even hold 50 stocks, and they look at the S&P top 50, and even that they can get close to 90% correlation. And so that really helps reduce the execution costs, which can be a drag on returns, right? If you're crossing bid ask, or if you're paying commission, that really kind of creates a drag on your returns. And so you want to minimize those execution costs. And you see that in JPI, it has an expense ratio of only 0.35% or something like that. So they do a really good job of minimizing execution costs. Now, how do they come up with those 100 companies? There's a couple of things they're looking at, most likely. One is which stocks which combination of stocks give them the right sector exposure that kind of leads to a higher correlation. But then two, with all that kind of given, they're looking for large cap, ideally low volatility stocks that aren't going to move around a lot, that probably pay a dividend if they can, and still have a reasonably high implied volatility. There might be some larger cap stocks that pay a decent dividend, but maybe the implied volatility is much, much lower than the benchmark. And so that might not be as attractive. And so that's what they're really looking for, because again, go back to the idea of maximizing risk adjusted returns, and you can do that by minimizing volatility. And so that is going to be the nature of the types of companies they're going to be looking for. But again, they want to hold enough of a basket of stocks that they will be trying to track that benchmark as closely as possible. Now, if you look at JPI's current construction, they hold a lot of financials and a lot of healthcare. Those tend to be lower volatility, not always, as we saw in March with financial stocks, but they tend to be lower volatility than, for instance, tech stocks. They tend to pay a little bit more of a dividend, but they tend to have a little bit lower implied volatility. And so they have to own some tech stocks as well. I mean, I think if we look at it in general, if we look at most tech stocks, even the large cap tech stocks, their dividend yield is below 1%. If we look at financial stocks, their dividend yield is usually around 2.5% to 3%. And if we look at healthcare stocks, their dividend yield is usually around 4%. But if we kind of go in the same order, the highest implied volatility for the most part are tech stocks. In the middle is financial stocks, and the lowest ones are healthcare. So they're looking for how they can maximize that income, whether it be dividend yield or implied volatility. And so that's the combination. But ultimately, for any sort of active strategy like this is, and even though it's an ETF, it's more of an active strategy because they're not fully replicating the benchmark, and they're holding stocks and then selling S&P options. So there is an active component. They're trying to find where they can minimize that tracking error and keep their costs low. So that's a big driver what JEPI is doing. And again, all towards maximizing risk-adjusted returns.
Thank you for that explanation. I want to talk a little bit more about JEPQ. And it's interesting how you're talking for about JEPI is that they're trying to use as little holdings as they can from the S&P. Like you said, they're only using 100. For JEPQ, it focuses on the NASDAQ, and they actually have around 81 holdings with their largest sector in information technology. So how does JEPQ stock selection process differ from JEPI? Is there a different benchmark in mind?
It's a different benchmark. They're looking at the NASDAQ versus the SPX, as you mentioned. And it's the same portfolio managers, right? So they're taking a similar approach. They're not going to be doing something materially different. My sense is what they found is that they need to hold a bigger basket in order to keep that correlation as high as possible, keep that tracking error low. And a lot of that might be because of the more top heavy skew on the weightings of the NASDAQ versus the S&P. And so they need to hold some more of those. The bigger names, the bigger performing names. And at the same time, they're not, NASDAQ has a lot of tech and biotech, which don't generate a lot of dividend yield. And therefore, they're going to be relying on options yield a lot. And as we talked about before, they hold a basket of stocks, but then they execute index options typically. And so that creates a lot of basis risk. And basis risk is where the collection of stocks within the index don't perform exactly the same as the index itself, right? And so if you don't hold everything in the index, you're at risk of underperforming the index and losing on your options and losing on your stocks. It's less likely to have that happen in the S&P 500 because of the diverse nature of the S&P 500. In a more concentrated index like the NASDAQ, it's more likely to have that basis risk. And so holding a higher percentage of the index is probably a way to minimize that basis risk and try to reduce overall risk and volatility of the strategy itself.
Thanks for talking a little bit more about the basis risk. So speaking of selection, what kind of investor would be interested in investing in JEPI? And how would this investor maybe be a little bit different from someone who's interested in JEPQ?
Well, so just comparing JEPI and JEPQ from an investor standpoint, that's going to be the question the investor wants to ask themselves is, do I like the S&P or do I like the NASDAQ? Right. And there's a plethora of reasons of why you might want to go into that. One of them might be valuation. Another one might be, what are the drivers of performance? What are the drivers of earnings? Right. Of course, NASDAQ right now is doing better because of its exposure to AI and things of that nature. And investors have shown a preference for that this year. That wasn't the case last year where people were worried about tech stocks because in a hawkish Fed, tech and biotech tend to be longer duration assets that are more negatively at risk when the Fed is hiking rates. So really the biggest question you have to ask yourself is going to be, do I want exposure to the S&P or do I want exposure to the NASDAQ? And that's the first question you should ask. As far as how these two are executed, like I said, same portfolio managers, a little bit different construction in terms of how they kind of go about it. But for the most part, they're doing the same thing where they're owning a basket of stocks that will track the index, minimize the tracking error, and they're selling index options. And so it's not the execution is really not that different between the two of them. The primary difference between the two of them is the benchmark index that they're tracking. Now, if we look at JEPQ, we could also look at QYLD, Q Yield, which is also a NASDAQ type of benchmark, but they execute very differently than JEPQ. And so if I compare those two ETFs, there's going to be a replication and composition difference that's what the investor is going to have to sort through. But for JEPI and JEPQ, it's really just as fairly, it's not, I can't say as simple as, but it really kind of comes down to, would I rather have exposure to S&P or NASDAQ?
So it's a lot more on like a personal level for each investor and maybe where the market is at, you would say?
Yeah. And I think you always want to ask yourself, how much, what's being priced into the market, right? And that's the primary reason why we look at the valuation of an index. Valuation is a horrible market timing indicator over the next 6 to 12 months. However, over the next 10 years, it's all that matters, right? The price you pay for something is over a 10-year horizon is the most statistically significant indicator of your returns. Over a near term, that it's not statistically significant. However, we can see from valuation where there might be a little bit more investor enthusiasm or even euphoria. If we look at it right now, for instance, you can make the case that both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ look expensive. And when I say that, if I take the inverse of the PE of either one of those, the inverse of the PE is what we call the earnings yield. It's a way for us to compare a yield on the stock market versus a yield on the bond market or a yield in cash, et cetera. And right now the PE on the S&P 500 is approximately 20. And that means it's an earnings yield of about 5%. Well, you can get more than 5% in cash and you can get close to 6% in corporate bonds. And so you have to ask yourself, well, is the S&P 500 earnings yield, is that attractive? I mean, I'm taking more risk in owning equities than I am if I owned fixed income or own cash. Is that risk worth it? Do I think I'll get the earnings growth that I need to justify that risk? And that's a question you probably want to ask yourself. For the NASDAQ, it's even more of a risk because for the NASDAQ, the PE is closer to 25. And so the earnings yield is closer to 4%. So you're actually paying a premium to own NASDAQ stocks. Again, presumably on the premise that you're going to get much stronger earnings growth, and that's why people do it. But I can say that this is the first time since the late 90s that we've seen the earnings yield on these indexes go below the level of cash. And so it can, as we saw in the 90s, that can persist for several years. There's nothing, there's no asymptote there. It can't happen. But it does tell you that things are fairly fully valued. And so you just have to ask yourself, go back to think about how Warren Buffett views the world and talk about margin of safety, right? Is there a margin of safety? I think it's pretty clear you can make the case there's not a margin of safety. That doesn't mean it's a bad investment. It just means that just understand the risks that you're taking. And so I think that's probably the first thing that investors want to consider is, are these risks the one worth taking? If we look at, comparatively, the Russell 2000 is negative for the year, or the DVY ETF is negative for the year, and the earnings yield is much, much higher. So you're getting, there are other indexes and other ETFs where you can actually replicate this cover call strategy yourself, where you might have a higher margin of safety. And that's just something to consider. Again, not financial advice. It's just something that investors should consider when they're considering these things.
Thank you for breaking that down a little bit. Maybe some investors that are watching this episode right now can take some advice from that. So JetBee has seen large inflows this year. I think it's been around $10 billion to be specific, which is, like I said, a pretty substantial amount. So were there any indicators to show why there was such a large influx of investments?
Well, I think the number one indicator is the outperformance that JEPI had versus the SPX last year. Investors chase performance, and that's not just retail investors, that's institutional investors as well. You would like to think that they do their homework and they understand what's a good strategy, and they want to bet on good strategy and good investment process. But the reality is, what we see time and time again, investors see what's performed well, and I want to own what's performed well. And that, for better or for worse, that's what's happened. And if we look at, in 2022, for the calendar year 2022, the total return on the S&P 500 index was -18%. The total return for the JEPI ETF was -3%. So it was down, but it outperformed by 15%. That's massive outperformance. And so that is the type of outperformance that you would expect would attract a lot of assets. And so I'm sure that became, especially in a difficult year to convince investors to allocate money to the stock market, I'm sure financial advisors were finding it much easier to tell their clients to allocate to something like JEPI. JEPQ also outperformed, not quite as much, but if you compare the JEPQ versus the triple Qs or the NASDAQ, it outperformed by about 7%. And so, it doesn't have as long a history. And so maybe that's why we didn't see as much of an inflow into JEPQ, because sometimes people want to see 3 years of history before they are willing to allocate. But the outperformance, I think, is the number one indicator that people that people might have. Now, another one that I might be reading into a little bit too much, but I think oftentimes when we have a market that was down as much as was, I don't think too many people coming into the year were forecasting the strength of the markets that we have seen this year. People thought maybe it would be a difficult economy, the markets are maybe priced in some of that, but maybe we would be a little bit more sideways this year and not really do a lot. Well, then that's kind of a perfect environment for covered call strategies in general. And so I'm sure that also kind of fed into the desire to allocate to covered call type of strategies. So the outperformance plus the idea of a sideways market in coming into this year, I'm sure were big drivers to what led to the, what led to the inflows. And, we've seen now that the shares outstanding in JPI have more than doubled in the last 12 months or so. And so that's all money coming into the product, right? So, and then that's, again, seemed to be the right product for the environment and it's shown good performance. And now those are the two things you typically see lead to inflows.
And you talked a little bit about how the market actually went up this year. So would you say JEPI and JPEQ's growth is maybe be challenged by that in the following year? Or is that something that's just still up in the air at the moment?
Yeah, it's possible, right? I mean, because the time when covered call strategies lag their benchmark is in strong bull markets. And we've seen a strong bull market, especially in the NASDAQ. And so, that I think investors will wait and see how the rest of the year plays out, I'm sure. But as they reassess and rebalance their portfolios looking into next year, maybe sometime in Q4 or towards the end of the year, that's certainly going to be a bit of a headwind, I would think, if the markets stay as strong as they have been. Strong bull markets are not good, on a relative basis for covered call strategies. Though, if we look at JPI, it's actually held its own this year. It's lagged for sure, but it's had positive returns, but it's only about 2 or 3% up versus 8% for the S&P. So it's still time. It could make that performance back up in the last 6 months. I would think that most people who have allocated will probably give it through the rest of the year. But yeah, strong bull markets, you'd rather own the index than a covered call strategy for sure.
So speaking of growth, JEPI and JEPQ, they're obviously not the only covered call ETFs in the market. So what incentives do JEPI and JEPQ offer that would maybe differentiate themselves from their competitors, such as QILD?
Well, QILD is, they do, if you look at their description, they do full replication. And so they're tracking the couple things. They're tracking the NASDAQ buy right. There's an index called BXN, which is the NASDAQ buy right, which JPQ would track. But BXNT, which is what QILD tracks, is executed a little bit differently. And it does full replication, which means it's going to hold all 100 stocks in the NASDAQ. It's not going to hold only 80 stocks, et cetera. And it's going to execute the at-the-money calls, and it's going to do so on up until the day before expiration, and it'll get out of that on a VWAP basis and then reinstate the next position. Whereas JPQ has a lot more flexibility in the options it sells, how it chooses to execute, how it chooses to hold things. And so that flexibility that JPQ has, if it's doing well and then the portfolio managers are doing a good job, can lead to outperformance versus a benchmark. QILD, if it's doing a good job, should track as closely as possible to the benchmark and would never outperform. If anything, would probably underperform by a little bit just because of costs of execution. So it's going to track the benchmark more closely. JPQ has a possibility of outperforming by more, but it also has a possibility of lagging by more too. And so, it depends on whether or not you're a believer of active versus passive management. QILD is more of a passive strategy. JPQ is more of an active strategy. It's not fully active, but it's more of an active strategy. And so that's probably the biggest differentiator that investors should consider, is how much they think that the portfolio managers can continue to outperform as they did in 2022 on a go-forward basis based on the way that they execute. And that kind of leads to one thing I wanted to kind of highlight is, if we just kind of go back, I talked about the Callan study that looked at the BXM index versus the SPX There was another one that was put up by Ennis Knupp on the PUT index, which is another SIBO benchmark. And what that does is it sells at the money puts and holds cash. So instead of holding the S&P 500 and selling an at the money call, it sells at the money puts and holds cash. It's a cash secured put. We know from put call parity that the payout diagram of those two structures, same strike, should look exactly the same, right? They should have the exact same returns because put call parity holds. What we saw though over a period of time was that the returns on the PUT index were actually about 1% higher per year than the BXM index, which, you know, you scratch your head and you say to yourself, well, that can't be, right? Put call parity holds, that can't be the case. AQR, which is a big quantitative fund manager, and Cliff Asness, who is a University of Chicago PhD, did this study that he published. It's on the Cboe website. And so, of course, as an academic, he looked at it and said, there's no way this can be the case. Something's wrong. This can't be the case. And so he looked at the 15 years of the indexes and looked at their performance. And what he found is that 1% of year difference in performance came entirely from the window in which the two indexes were created and then rolled. So, you know, if we looked at the BXM index from the third Friday, Friday after the third Wednesday of the month, so option expiration from 11:30 to 12, it would essentially close out the option that it was short and then re-roll it to the next month and sell it. So over a very small window of time. In the PUT index, they used a 2-hour window instead of a half an hour window. And so for that 2-hour window, their exposure to the index was quite different than the BXM index. And what he found is that simply because of that difference of the execution window of an hour and a half once a month, every month, it led to 1% outperformance of the PUT index. If you took out the performance over that window, they at put call parity held the rest of the year. So it was really about 15 hours a year or 18 hours a year of the year caused all of that difference in performance. And so I highlight that because when we think about like a JEPQ versus a QILD, that execution difference can lead to a meaningful difference in performance. And so you have to ask yourself, you know, is that something that you think is important? Because sometimes you might think, well, does it really matter that you know? And the thing to understand as well is the market understands when these bigger ETFs have to do their execution, and they kind of position accordingly. A different JP Morgan option strategy, which is a more of a mutual fund, it's JHEQX, is their JP Morgan's hedged equity structure. And tomorrow, June 30th, they have, everyone knows the strike of their short call that they have because they sell a call to buy a put spread. And it's the 4320 strike in the SPX expiring tomorrow morning. Everyone knows about it. Everyone knows they're going to look for the reroll, and the market's positioning accordingly. And when you're big enough that the market knows what position you have and when you have to roll it, it becomes difficult to execute, right? And your costs of execution go up. And so sometimes having the freedom that JEPI and JPQ have to execute at different times and in different ways can give them a little bit more freedom to not allow the market to position for these big roles that they have and give them a little more flexibility. And so those are things that I think people want to consider, that the cost of execution can be a big driver of performance and really don't undersell how much that can impact your performance.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how the execution difference can cause such a different outcome, I guess. It's not something that I really considered before. So thanks for talking a little bit about that. We got through the bulk of the covered call ETF questions. I have a few final questions just to wrap up the conversation. The first one being is, what are some of the most important lessons you've learned while working with derivatives in your career?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say that the three things that I would say are the most important life lessons from working with derivatives. And I say life lessons because they don't relate just to my investment process and how I think about investing, but they probably impact how I do everything in my life and for better or for worse. And one is to understand that there's a distribution of outcomes. not, life isn't linear. Returns aren't linear. There's a path dependency to that. And so understand that there's going to be a distribution of outcomes. And so when you're thinking about, well, hey, I think this stock can go up or down, ask yourself, what's the path of that going to look like? How much can it go up? Could I be too pessimistic, or how much could it go down? Could I be too optimistic? And understand that there's going to be a distribution for any given stock or any given market or any given asset class. And just understand that there's a distribution of outcomes. And that's the same for could be the same thing for your career. It could be the same thing for the classes you take at school. There's going to be a distribution of outcomes, right? You're going to get, you're going to do better in some classes versus other classes. You're going to do better at certain points of your career than other points of your career. And so kind of following up on that is, like, nothing's linear, right? Sometimes things can move exponentially and sometimes things don't move at all. And so there's nothing that says that just because we think the market goes up on average 6% a year, that it's going to go up 6% every year in a straight line, 50 basis points a month. That's just not how the world works. And so understand that and use options. You can use options as a way to manage the risk of that portfolio. You can use options as a way then to tactically take directional exposure that maybe augments some of your views. But just understand that there's not a linearity, and sometimes owning that convexity of an option, whether it be the insurance or it be the tactical upside, owning the convexity is and having convexity in your portfolio, or having convexity in the distribution of outcomes of your career is always a good thing. So always try to own that optionality. And then the last thing I would say is, I think of everything in terms of reward to risk. We've talked a little bit about risk-adjusted returns, but I want to normalize every sort of opportunity. So someone might say, well, this thing's going to go up 5%, and that's going to go up 15%. And I ask myself, okay, that sounds fine, but what's my risk on the 15% asset versus what's my risk on the 5% asset? So for instance, if we look at stocks right now, if I say, okay, the market's up, can go, let's say that I think the stock market can go up another 15% over the next 12 months. But I know the volatility is going to be something between 15 and 20%. Okay, that's a sharp ratio, roughly, give or take, I'd call it a sharp ratio of less than one, right? It's maybe 0.7 or so. Let's look at cash. It can only go up 5% in the next 12 months because that's what the returns on the short-term paper is, but the risk is zero. I know I'm going to get 5%. And so that's a much higher sharp ratio than the stock market, even though the potential return on the stock market is much higher. And so I look at a reward to risk ratio, and that helps me kind of crystallize how I try to make those decisions. Now, of course, when the return on cash is close to zero, then you're more willing to take risk. And that's part of what the Fed was trying to get everyone to do. But I always think of every sort of opportunity as not just what's the reward, but what's the risk. And I think that that's a good way to kind of go through analyzing and normalizing the different opportunities that you might have.
So keeping that risk to reward ratio, and then your quote, life isn't linear. I'm definitely going to keep that in mind when I'm exploring my career, as I'm going to be graduating in a few years. My final question is that every week we choose a topic for the show. Do you have any recommendations of a topic that we could cover that we could use to learn more about options?
Well, I don't know what you covered before, but I think I would certainly try to think about, you've probably looked at kind of the VIX ETFs, et cetera. I would say that maybe the most interesting thing is to look at right now the popularity of zero day to expiry options and binary options at the CME. If you looked at that, I think those are very interesting. And when I say interesting, I say in a risky sort of way. I think there's a lot more risk that's going into some of those than people kind of let on, especially now that a lot more retail accounts are selling those options versus buying those options. And so that to me is where I look at potential risk exposure to the market. And so I would say that that's something that I think is interesting. But again, I don't know what other things you've been looking at, but I would say that I would also consider I don't know to what extent you guys look at options on other asset classes. I would think that we've seen a growing open interest and growing volume on options in agricultural products at the CME. And that's something I've been writing about a few times this year. A lot more people are getting interested in, and maybe it's because it's an inflation hedge, et cetera. Maybe because of the issues of food scarcity and food security. There's a lot of growing interest from not just institutional accounts for those products. And so those are a few ideas that kind of come to mind that I would think.
Thanks for giving me some of those ideas. I'll definitely look into them. Every week is a new topic. So all of those are potential topics that we could cover. That's all I have for you today, Rich. So thanks again for coming on and sharing some of your knowledge about covered call ETFs. I know I learned quite a bit, and I hope our viewers did too. And to our viewers, I'll see you all in the next episode.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
If you're hungry for more options content, make sure to subscribe to the JLN YouTube channel and check out our social media accounts. Be sure to check out our website, johnlothiannews.com, MarketsWiki, and the John Lothian newsletter for more content.